This is the Environment Show. It's about our stewardship of the Earth and the beauty and mystery of life in all its forms. I'm Peter Burley. Coming up, grizzly bears. They're surviving in the Yellowstone ecosystem. Should some be introduced in Idaho? Are they doing well enough to take them off the endangered species list? It's been the hottest summer on record. Negotiations are now underway at a conference in Bonn, Germany, on implementation of the United Nations Convention on Climate Change. Listeners express indignation about marketing genetically engineered crops, President Clinton's advocacy of biofuels, and the game of golf. And on the Earth calendar, wood ducks are squawking in Tennessee as they migrate south for the winter. These stories and more coming up on The Environment Show. You're listening to The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. At one point, grizzly bears in the lower 48 states were almost extinct. But thanks to federal protection, their numbers are increasing. And now, a debate is beginning about whether or not the grizzly should be removed from the endangered species list. The Environment Show's Mark Brody reports.
Grizzly bears went on the federal endangered species list in 1975 when their numbers were dropping quickly. At that time, there were an estimated 200 to 300 grizzlies in the Yellowstone ecosystem. In the years immediately preceding the bears being put on the list, between 60 and 70 grizzlies were killed each year by humans. That was a far cry from the grizzlies of the past who roamed over much of the western part of the United States. Now, 24 years after being listed as an endangered species, grizzlies are coming back, or at least they're not going away, depending on who you talk to. The exact number of grizzlies in the U.S. is a debatable figure, partly because of the difficulty in tracking and counting them. But the Sierra Club's Grizzly Bear Ecosystem Project Coordinator Louisa Wilcox says just having grizzly bears around in 1999 is a success story.
The good news is the Endangered Species Act has worked. The bear was put on the endangered species list in 1975 when numbers were plummeting and there was deep concern about the potential extinction at that time. The good news is that decline has been stabilized. There are still about the same number of grizzlies, though, as there were when they were put on the endangered list. There's about 1,000, but they're separated into five relatively small isolated island ecosystems. The bad news is that they haven't been increasing significantly enough, nor is the habitat secure enough to make the coast clear for delisting or removal of endangered species protection.
Wilcox and the Sierra Club think it's premature to consider delisting grizzlies. She says there are serious concerns about the bear's habitat. Wilcox says before the bears come off the endangered species list, officials have to be sure that they won't slip back onto the brink of extinction. Despite all the talk about the possible delisting, the grizzly bear recovery coordinator for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, Chris Servine, says the department has not proposed taking grizzlies off the list, nor have they begun to consider the move. Servine says the service is simply working on the conservation strategy, which includes a management plan for grizzlies in the Yellowstone area in the event they're taken off the list, an activity Servine says is just one task to be completed before any delisting action takes place.
The objective of listing any species is to delist it. What we're doing with the grizzly bear is working on implementing the recovery plan, and what we're committed to in the long term is a very responsive management system that will be adaptive and be able to respond to any changes in the environment, to changes in human activity, to changes in food level, to assure the existence of the grizzly bears in the long term.
Servine says one way to help facilitate delisting that's currently being considered is a reintroduction plan for the bears, something that the organization Defenders of Wildlife strongly favors. Reintroducing the bears would in effect bridge the gap between the biggest populations located in the Yellowstone area in Wyoming and parts of Montana. This would allow the grizzly population to grow, as well as provide an essential geographic link between the groups of bears. Dr. Mark Schaefer, the Vice President for Programs at Defenders of Wildlife, says the Selway Bitterroot ecosystem in east central Idaho has suitable wilderness for the grizzlies to live in. He says he'd like to see grizzlies reintroduced everywhere possible, but he realizes there are some limits.
We recognize that the days are gone when you're going to have grizzlies from the Mississippi to the Pacific and from the Arctic Circle down to Mexico, but there are still many places that could support grizzlies. Particularly if they're well managed with a light hand. and we'd like to see them return to as many places as possible.
As might be expected, some residents in possible reintroduction areas are concerned about grizzlies roaming around. To try and ease some of the worries, Defenders of Wildlife came up with the Citizen Management Plan, which aims to give local communities a say over how a reintroduced grizzly bear population would be managed. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, which has the ultimate say in whether or not grizzlies are delisted, is in favor of the reintroduction proposal in the Selway Bitterroot area. The service's Chris Servine says reintroducing the bears into that ecosystem would help increase the number of grizzlies.
If you look at the big picture, grizzly bears have been eliminated from about 98% of their habitat south of Canada. And we have very few areas left where it's possible to maintain grizzly bears because of the wild nature of the land and the large blocks of wild land that are necessary to maintain a grizzly bear population. And this Bitterroot ecosystem that we're speaking of for reintroduction is probably the best possible place to reintroduce bears and to gain another grizzly bear population south of Canada.
Back at Defenders of Wildlife, Mark Schaefer says if there are more bears now than there were 24 years ago, it's very difficult to tell. Even still, he says he wouldn't be surprised to see grizzlies, at least in the Yellowstone region, delisted within the next 2 years. But Dave Moody of the Wyoming Fish and Game Commission says he doesn't think any action will be taken for several years. He says even though his agency believes it's time to consider delisting, there's currently too much debate over essential facts, the actual number of grizzlies, available habitat, and concerns over food supply to warrant such action. It's true that many of these issues are in doubt, Moody says, in part because different organizations use different techniques to look at the same data, which causes them to arrive at different conclusions. But Moody says there's another reason for the disparity.
I think environmental groups, as well as agencies, as well as other organizations, basically have a bottom line when it comes to where their stance is on the grizzly bear issue. And I think that, at least at this point in time, I think people are going to be extremely reluctant to move off of that, regardless of what piece of data is brought forward.
Moody says his personal feeling is that there's an overreaction to how quickly grizzlies could be delisted. He says he's also concerned that once a decision is made, nobody will be completely happy with it and that it'll end up in court. That could further delay any delisting action and could possibly cause good science to be ignored. But the Sierra Club's Louisa Wilcox believes grizzly bears are important enough for agencies and organizations to take their time with before making any decision. She says grizzlies are the most sensitive barometer of how ecosystems in Rocky Mountain regions are doing.
As goes the grizzly, so grow many other species of wildlife. If the bear is healthy, so are big game species, so tend to be songbirds, so tend to be fisheries and the like. So if you're doing well with grizzly bear recovery, you're doing well with the whole ecosystem and its complex interactions within it. You're also doing well by the human communities that depend on this wild land area as well for their economic health and well-being.
Wilcox says she'll fight any possible grizzly bear delisting even though there aren't any proposals pending. But there is the feeling that where there's talk, action can't be far behind. Reporting for The Environment Show, I'm Mark Brody.
A hot summer at the close of a hot decade is now over. The U.S. National Climate Data Center says 1998 was the warmest year since records began in the late 19th century. The weight of scientific opinion today is global climate change is being influenced by what we burn, specifically fossil fuels like coal and petroleum products. In 1992, the United Nations adopted a framework convention on climate change which set ground rules under which industrialized countries are to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. 155 nations have signed the convention, and it entered into force on March 21, 1994. Since that time, four negotiating sessions have been held to work out procedures for implementation. Despite this, emissions from the United States have continued to increase. This week, a conference of the parties begins in Bonn, Germany. Recently, I discussed the negotiations with Jennifer Morgan, climate campaign director with the World Wildlife Fund, an environmental organization that favors implementation of the treaty. and with Glenn Kelly, Executive Director of the Global Climate Coalition. That's a group that represents energy producers and industry, and it has opposed governmental controls designed to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. My understanding is that we've got a new climate change meeting coming up. Jennifer, what are some of the things on the agenda?
Negotiators are now in the process of filling in the rules for the Kyoto Protocol that was agreed almost 3 years ago now on things like emissions trading and the use of forests in the agreement. So those are the things on the table. We're looking for environment ministers to come and talk about how they're actually starting to reduce their emissions so they can start meeting their Kyoto targets.
And Glenn, what are the objectives that your group has for that meeting?
Well, we're very interested in seeing how the discussions proceed on the flexible mechanisms. Now, these are tools that were built into the treaty to try and minimize some of the very real economic costs we see associated with it. And there are some groups that are out there trying to limit the ability for countries to and businesses to use those flexible mechanisms. And we're hoping that our administration negotiators are going to get some further progress. We know that we've been right on board with them all along on the 100% flexibility. And
what is a flexible mechanism in this context?
It's well, Jennifer pointed two of them out. One is an emissions trading system that allows trade of carbon emissions permits. Another is a clean development mechanism. And the third is joint implementation. And these are just market-based mechanisms and also sinks that can be used to offset some of the costs we see coming out of this treaty.
Do you see any effort to change the targets themselves or an evaluation about how far we've come to reach any of those targets?
I've not heard much discussion at all, Peter, about changing those targets. You know, one of the things that we understand our administration negotiators are interested in doing is trying to build support for additional participation from developing countries within the context of the treaty. We are hopeful that those discussions will continue and that further progress can be made.
The ministers are scheduled to talk about progress that they've made so far in reducing emissions. I don't see any change in the targets themselves, but the concern of the World Wildlife Fund is that the rules for the Kyoto Protocol need to make sure that there's a reduction of global warming pollution in the atmosphere, and that's not clear as of yet.
And one of the things that we hear frequently is the concept of sinks. Jennifer, take us through that quickly. What is a sink?
A sink is basically either often seen as, say, a forest that absorbs carbon dioxide and so will hold carbon dioxide in a stable point, which is a good thing. It provides, you know, a balance to our carbon cycle in the atmosphere. The debate that is going on is asking how much should a country be able to meet its target by absorbing carbon dioxide in trees and in agricultural systems instead of reducing carbon dioxide, in other words, keeping the fossil fuel in the ground to meet their targets.
Glenn, I know one of the things that's been proposed by some is that if you build a plant that creates emissions in one place, in fact, I think there are utilities that are doing this, you go out and plant trees somewhere else. Is this a useful idea or is it simply quaint?
Well, I think it's a very useful idea. In terms of helping offset carbon emissions, sinks are a very valuable tool. You know, we've seen some interesting research. There's still a lot more research to be done, but some interesting stuff is on the table already that suggests that the United States and North America on a whole is a net carbon sink, meaning that the plants and the soils absorb more carbon dioxide than is put into the atmosphere. Still a lot of work to be done on that research, but it's very encouraging to show yet again that this treaty's got some serious questions still left in it.
I would find that that type of research actually and the use of the Clinton administration perhaps of that type of a provision as extremely problematic because the difference of a sink, a tree, versus keeping fossil fuel in the ground, the certainty levels are quite extreme. What happens if that tree goes on fire or there's a pest? So we just want to make sure that you reduce emissions and that you don't find excuses for not reducing emissions.
And talking about emissions reduction, what is the lowest hanging fruit on the tree? Where could we get the most reductions, the most rapidly, and the most economically?
Well, I think that one area for that is the fact that our cars and our light trucks are not very efficient, and the biggest single step that you could move is to having those sport utility vehicles meet the same efficiency standards as cars. And the other thing is that Americans waste two-thirds of our energy when we generate electricity. So if we were to close that efficiency gap, we could reduce emissions quite a bit as well.
And if I could, Pierre.
Yes, Glenn, what are the two big areas that you think we could...
Well, I hesitate to point to two in particular because low-hanging fruit is being picked every day. As I pointed out in a previous show, we've got Partnership for New Generation Vehicle. We've got clean coal technologies. We've got climate change initiatives that are ongoing through the utility industry. And all these are making progress in terms of taking steps to address emissions of greenhouse gases. And they're ongoing. The subject of intense investment by American businesses. So I think it's occurring right now.
I want to thank my guests, Jennifer Morgan from the World Wildlife Fund and Glenn Kelly from the Global Climate Coalition, who have joined us from Washington, D.C. We welcome two more stations that are among the more than 200 that now broadcast The Environment Show. They're WVCS-FM in California, Pennsylvania, and KQAL-FM in Winona, Minnesota. Nature Sounds are provided by Lang Elliott at Nature Sound Studio, www.naturesound.com. The Environment Show is a national production which is made possible by the W. Walton Jones Foundation, the William Bingham Foundation, the Turner Foundation, the J.M. Kaplan Fund, and Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the collector car hobby. www.hemmings.com. Listen to The Environment Show anytime through our website. The address is www.enn.com/envshow. That's www.enn.com/envshow. Many of our listeners are sharing their thoughts with us, and Mary Darcy tells us what some of you are saying.
A listener by the name of Phil called our comment line after hearing a discussion on the environmental effects of genetically modified crops. He had this to say.
The baloney that the corporations put out about the safety of genetically engineered crops, there are many, many, many studies that show that this is not validated, that these tests are not thorough, they're not longitudinal. It's obviously a ploy to make more money by the biotech corporations. And the worst thing of it is that they don't allow, so far, the labeling of those foods. Now, why can't we have a choice, whether right or wrong? I think the American people have a right to decide for themselves what they shall eat and not have that stuff passed onto them where they have no choice because they don't know what they're getting. Thank you.
Another listener heard a report we aired on President Clinton's initiative to promote the use of biomass fuels and products. Richard contacted us by email to say that he was puzzled by the statement that biofuels contribute no CO2 from their combustion. He went on to say, quote, "The report completely neglected two issues regarding the use of our farm soils. First, the world is losing farmland to industry, housing, commercial development, salinization, and erosion. But the demand for food increases as population increases and as less efficient eating habits habits become more widespread with economic improvements. Can we justify losing more of our food production capability to growing crops that satisfy our wasteful appetite for fuels in the U.S.? Second, agricultural waste and other organic materials are better used to protect and build the soil rather than be burned. The loss of soil, together with ongoing pollution associated with heavy reliance on inorganic fertilizers, is one of the greatest underpublicized environmental and agricultural problems facing the U.S. and other nations. End quote. A listener named Michael heard a discussion on the environmental impacts of golf courses. He says he's concerned about the effects a golf course is having on a lake near his home. It happens to be the lake from which the town draws its drinking water. He adds,
the pesticides that are being used in golf courses here and across the country are not being used to prevent disease or anything. They're being used to promote a game. So why are we even risking it? The toxic cosmetic maintenance of a game. That's what this is about. It's silly. We should go back to playing golf like they did in Scotland with rocks and weeds and the terrible intrusions of songbirds and frogs and turtles and things like that.
We appreciate all comments, questions, and suggestions. You can reach our comment line by dialing 1-888-49-GREEN. That's 1-888-49-GREEN. For the Environment Show, I'm Mary Darcy.
Hello, operator. I want you to be mine. Deposit all your love and put me on the line. I'm listed under lonely, lost and feeling small. Dial directly to my heart and bill me for the call.
And now it's time for the Earth Calendar. That's the call of the wood duck, and right now, they're migrating south through Tennessee. Like many other waterfowl, wood duck migrate in the fall to their wintering grounds. Male wood ducks, called drakes, are considered by many to be North America's most beautiful duck. Ed Warr, wildlife biologist with Tennessee's Wildlife Resources Agency, describes what they look like.
It's multicolored, has reddish. The males have a reddish kind of a bill and a greenish head with a crest, and the wings, if you ever see one up close, have some bluish speculum and some white borders at the base.
During the 18th century, the wood duck was hunted to near extinction, but thanks to a huge conservation effort, the bird has made a comeback. Ed Warr says wood ducks are not the only waterfowl migrating through Tennessee at this time of year.
I mean, a canvasback is a duck that everybody likes to see. It's a beautiful duck. It's a large diving duck. Also, ruddy ducks, they're not real visible if you don't really know what you're looking at. And there's some beautiful ducks, such as the bufflehead and the golden eye, which are another diving duck. Sometimes we'll get sea ducks, like eiders and what we call old squall. Some people call those long-tailed ducks, and they'll come down through, and they're a rare sight.
Ed says another duck migrating through is the blue-winged teal. It's a fast flyer that will winter in South America. Their summers are spent in Canada and the prairies of the northern United States. The teal, wood duck, and other birds are using the Mississippi Flyway. A flyway is a route that birds follow to make their migrations. Think of a flyway as a ladder with lakes, ponds, and other waterways representing rungs on the ladder. Rung by rung, the birds migrate south, stopping to refuel and rest. Without these rest areas, the birds would be unable to complete their migration and could not survive. This makes protecting wetland areas important not only to animals that rely on an ecosystem year-round, but to migrating species as well. Ed Warr describes where many of the rungs are located in Tennessee.
And there are some federal refuges, which are concentration points for these birds, like Realfoot Lake, or also at Tennessee National Wildlife Refuge on Kentucky Lake. And these complexes winter the majority of our birds, or, you know, our service staging areas for these birds. But also the state also manages waterfowl areas scattered about, and birds use those too. But West Tennessee is our primary wintering or staging area for waterfowl.
Over the years, Tennessee has lost wetlands, which means migrating birds are concentrated. This could put a strain not only on the animals, but on the ecosystem as well. Ed Warr says the state is taking steps to preserve and create wetland areas.
But who knows? If we substitute shopping center parking lots for wetlands, we may be putting rungs in the ladder for motorists migrating south for the winter. You're listening to The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. This is The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. Still ahead, low-level radioactive waste. It's produced not only in nuclear power plants, but in hospitals all over the country. You only have to store it for 500 years, but we still don't have a place to put it. We talk with two experts that are wrestling with a problem. And in the second part of our two-part series on the captive breeding of endangered species, we hear about how it's done and whether it can really save animals from extinction. Stay with us. We are Talking Green, and I'm Peter Burley. Today we're going to be talking about low-level radioactive nuclear waste and what to do about it. And since low-level waste is being produced in a lot of places, even your local hospital, and few communities want to store it in their backyards, the question is what to do with this continuing problem. What are the implications for the environment, for our health, and for the organizations that generate it? My guests are Holmes Brown, and he is Director of State and Federal Relations with Afton Associates. That's an environmental consulting firm. And he is also facilitator for the Low-Level Waste Forum based in Washington, D.C. And the forum works with state officials and regulators who work with low-level nuclear waste problems. Also with us is Nikki Hobson. And she is Communications Director for the California Radioactive Materials Management Forum. And that's an association of public and private institutions that actually generate low-level radioactive waste. And she's in that administrative area that includes Arizona, California, North and South Dakota. So to begin, Holmes Brown, what is low-level radioactive waste and how does it differ from any other kind of radioactive waste?
It's a pleasure to be on the show, and thanks for inviting Nikki and I to participate. Low-level radioactive waste are materials that are contaminated with radioactivity at relatively low levels. That's a comparative term used to distinguish low-level waste from materials like spent nuclear fuel that comes out of nuclear power plants that is radioactive, highly radioactive for tens of thousands of years.
And so when you say low-level contamination, what does that mean?
Low-level waste actually covers quite a variety of materials, but the general standard is that the Federal Nuclear Regulatory Commission in 1961 established criteria by which to determine whether materials were low-level waste or higher than low-level waste. And in general, what they said was if materials decay to a level after 500 years where they don't pose a significant hazard to humans, that would constitute low-level waste.
Okay, so without being facetious, the notion is that you've only got to keep it 500 years as opposed to 238,000. Is that really the choice?
That's correct. And I think what the NRC felt was that the humans have built institutions and facilities where there's a reasonable assurance that they can last for 500 years for some considerable amount of time. And so that was the criteria that they used to say, this is low-level waste. And under federal law of 1980, states were given responsibility for providing for the disposal of the commercially generated low-level waste in this country. The federal government has responsibility for defense-related low-level waste.
Okay.
So what Nikki and I are dealing with is the commercial side of things.
Well, Nikki, you can help us here. Where does this stuff come from? We're now talking, as I understand it, about waste that will become harmless in 500 years. Who's making this stuff?
Well, I might just backtrack for 1 second before I answer your question, and to mention that of all the commercial low-level waste that's generated, 98% of it, by far the vast majority of it, will no longer be hazardous after only 100 years. It's only that remaining 2 or 3% that will have to be isolated from human contact for up to 500 years. I can speak from personal experience in California. It comes from medical procedures, it comes from research, it comes from universities, nuclear utilities, and other industries. Low-level waste is generated by hundreds, even thousands, of common daily activities.
Now, when we think of what it is, too, I think a lot of people think about fuel rods and tanks, but you're talking about all kinds of things like clothing and everything else, aren't you?
Yeah, we're talking about just a kind of a wide assortment of garbage, anywhere from beakers and test tubes that are used in a research laboratory, to booties or coveralls that are worn by someone who is handling radioactive materials. And these things do become slightly contaminated with radiation in the process of their use. They are put into a barrel that's labeled low-level radioactive waste and handled in a very specific way to make sure that both the workers and the public are kept safe.
And before we talk about what we do with it, I assume we're talking about large numbers of barrels nationwide, are we not?
Actually, in California, there is less than 100,000 cubic feet of waste generated each year, quite a bit less than 100,000 cubic feet. So we are not talking about huge volumes of waste. Holmes may be able to come up with some national statistics.
Yeah, Holmes, if we're thinking nationwide, are we talking about freight car loads? Or are we talking about...
Yes, you're talking about freight car loads. I believe that the statistic that folks have given is that the total national volume would cover a football field about 6 to 8 feet deep.
On an annual basis?
That's on an annual basis. So the fact is it isn't a terribly large amount of waste. For instance, when you compare it to the amount of solid waste, say municipal trash and such, generated in the nation annually, it's about 1/10,000th by volume.
I was going to say, as a New Yorker, when you're describing garbage, that doesn't even sound like enough garbage to worry about.
This is I was going to mention this later in the show, talking about the issues of equity of disposal distribution, but New York City currently ships 2,000 tons of municipal garbage waste to Virginia every day. So that gives you some idea. Now, again, I think both Nikki and I don't wish to understate the care and caution that one should treat low-level waste with, but at least in terms of volume, it's certainly a small volume compared to other types of garbage that are generated in the country.
So basically, we're talking about garbage that's got to be stored somehow securely for 500 years. What is being done with it today? Holmes, you want to take a crack at that?
Well, I'll start with that, and then Nikki can talk a bit about the situation in California. Again, in 1961, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission reviewed the performance of the first round of nuclear waste disposal sites, And there were lessons learned from those sites, including the one in West Valley, and they came up with new standards, new construction criteria, and so forth, all of which were designed to securely contain the waste for the period of its hazard. Currently, there is a site in Barnwell, South Carolina, which is accepting waste from throughout the nation. There is a facility operating in Hanford, Washington, which is accepting waste from two interstate compacts, and we can talk a bit about the compact system a bit later, the Northwest and the Rocky Mountain Compact. And finally, there is a facility in Utah which is accepting this lower activity waste that Nikki referred to, again, from throughout the country.
Now, these facilities, are they basically big above-ground boxes that this stuff is put in?
These facilities actually are underground trenches. They are excavated. They have, with the higher activity waste, they have concrete barriers over top, and then they are covered over after the waste is emplaced in them. The waste is emplaced in them in metal boxes, and it's very carefully recorded as to what waste is in there, where it came from, and so forth. And these sites are licensed, reviewed by the states. In fact, the states have a regulatory person on site during all our hours of operation.
And you mentioned West Valley. 20 years ago, when I was environmental commissioner in the state of New York, we struggled with that. That was one of these sites that perhaps was not built according to current standards.
That's correct.
And the water flowed through the bottom of it, and indeed when it came out on other people's property elsewhere, it was radioactive.
Well, that's right. And, I actually worked at the National Governors Association at that point, and I had many dealings with regulatory officials in New York, and that's precisely the type of problem that the new regulations are designed to avoid.
Now, Nikki, in California, you've had quite a fight about building a new one of these at Ward Valley. What's been going on there?
Well, California was one of the first states to step forward to accept its responsibility under the Low-Level Waste Policy Act that Holmes referred to. It was originally enacted in 1980 and amended in 1985.
And just by shorthand, that was the federal act that says that each state's got to be able to take care of its own. Is that right?
That's true. That's true. It delegated the responsibility for low-level waste to the states. California set out to implement their portion of the Policy Act. They passed legislation early in the 1980s, selected a licensee in mid-1980, and went through a extensive process. We're looking at 17 years now, from 1982 when California first began. We have been unable to build a facility, even though the state has licensed the site here in the southeastern desert of California, because we cannot get possession of the land from the federal government. What this has done to the generators, the waste generators, the hospitals and the universities and nuclear power plants and other people who use radioactive materials, is it has really put them in a bind, and they are now currently storing the waste on site where it is generated. This is an environmental show, and I think it's just obvious to almost anyone who looks at this situation that this is an environmental solution that is probably the worst of all worlds.
Well, does that mean that in California, every hospital, university, whatever, that's generating this stuff, whether it be through medical procedures or research, is basically stuffing into the cellar and holding onto it?
Many of them are. Some California generators have been shipping to the Barnwell, South Carolina site or to the Utah site. Many others have elected not to ship to those sites because of concern, legal concern about liability in case something goes wrong at those sites in the future.
Now, your problem, though, in citing that one, I think illustrates a national problem. You decided through whatever process you have that XYZ was the ideal site. The federal government owned it, and then I presume for a combination of scientific and political reasons, the federal government decided not to give the state the land, thereby blocking the construction. Is that what happened?
Well, that's almost exactly right. Actually, the Bush administration had decided to transfer the land to California. The state must have title to the land. So the Bush administration did decide to transfer the land to California. However, before that happened, the Clinton administration was inaugurated, and one of the first acts that the new Secretary of the Interior, Bruce Babbitt, did was to reverse the Bush administration's decision on Ward Valley. And thus began the long struggle that's been going on since 1983.
And I gather there are people in California who feel very strongly that this shouldn't go forward, which I'm sure is some of the sentiment that caused this to happen. Does this raise the larger problem that nobody really wants one of these things? And if that's the case, is it irresponsible to keep on generating low-level nuclear waste?
Well, there are opponents to just about any project you ever undertake. However, I think that mainstream Californians understand that the benefits that come to us from the use of radioactive materials are huge. And, you know, to say, well, we're simply going to stop generating low-level waste means that we would also have to give up the benefits.
And I assume you're talking about things like X-rays that all of us presumably use all the time.
There are 14 million medical procedures each year that use radioactive materials. Not all of them generate low-level waste, but lots of them do. There, in California, we have a huge biotechnology industry that is doing research to find cures for cancer and AIDS and Alzheimer's disease. Their research absolutely depends on the use of radioactive materials. We cannot, you know, go on in a modern world and expect the modern benefits, the health benefits, the safety benefits, and the convenience benefits that come from radioactive materials and not deal honestly with the waste problem.
So, Holmes, where do we go from here? You work with states that are struggling with this.
Yeah.
I assume lots of states have siting problems. What next?
The opposition to any number of types of projects is certainly not unique to California. I mean, even sometimes people want to build a new church or something and folks object to the parking, so you have opponents to almost anything. I think the folks that I work with, first of all, are convinced that low-level nuclear waste, when properly managed and disposed of, can be safely done. They're state officials whose job is to protect the public health and safety, and that's what they want to assure. Secondly, there are, in fact, some communities that are interested in low-level waste sites. The Barnwell facility in South Carolina has enjoyed considerable community support ever since it was opened. The facility in Hanford, Washington, again, is in a nuclear complex, and I think the local folks understand nuclear materials and what protections need to be taken. I think the real challenge for state and compact officials is to provide assurances to the public that the facilities that are being proposed are safe and are going to contain the materials. And that's what a lot of people are doing. In fact, there have been considerable benefits from the low-level waste program to date. For instance, the volumes of waste that have been generated have diminished. The waste form that is being buried is much more stable than it was 20 years ago.
I want to thank my guests. Holmes Brown, he's with Afton Associates, which is an environmental consulting firm that works with low-level nuclear waste. And Nikki Hobson with the California Radioactive Materials Management Forum, which represents organizations that actually generate low-level radioactive nuclear waste. We know that you have thoughts about this, so we hope you'll share them with us. Our number is 1-888-49-GREEN. We've been talking green, and I'm Peter Burley. As always, we'd like to hear from you. Our email address is green@wamc.org. That's green@wamc.org. Regular mail, it's The Environment Show. 318 Central Avenue, Albany, New York, 12206. Scientists tell us that our planet is experiencing the largest mass extinction since the dinosaur age. Endangered species breeding programs are one tool that is being used by zoos to save some critters from extinction. The effort includes natural breeding, artificial insemination, and in vitro fertilization, and a number of these efforts have been successful. Last week, we told you about breeding programs at the Cincinnati Zoo and at the Audubon Institute in New Orleans. In this second of our two-part series on endangered species breeding programs, the Environment Show's Stephen Westcott looks at two institutions that have historical roots in the field and why such programs by themselves cannot stop extinction.
Breeding exotic animals is challenging work. There's a lot more to it than just putting a male and a female in a cage with the hope that they like each other. Cheetahs, for example, are traditionally solitary animals and don't care much for the company of others, except during the mating season. But by researching the animal's hormonal cycle and behavior, the San Diego Zoo has been successful in breeding this beautiful feline. Joan Embry is conservation ambassador for the zoo. She's worked there for 30 years, and you may recognize her from her appearances on The Tonight Show and other national programs.
We found when the females were cycling and receptive to the males by introducing them at the appropriate time, we could be successful and had the first cheetah born in the Western Hemisphere in 1970. His name was Juba, and it was quite an event. And based on the information collected with that program, we have now had over 100 cheetah born at our wild animal park, which is significant. Looking at the entire world captive population is somewhere around 1,200.
Natural breeding is just one method being conducted at the San Diego Zoo. Embry says the zoo has a center dedicated to breeding endangered species, where researchers in a number of disciplines propagate animals through a variety of methods.
Well, the Center for Reproduction of Endangered Species is a multifaceted representation of our scientific knowledge in fields everything from ecology to pathology, virology, behavior, reproductive physiology, endocrinology, genetics, all of these areas are covered to give expertise in each of those fields. Often they work as a team to address some of the serious issues with wildlife.
The center breeds some animals for captivity while others are introduced to the wild. Researchers have been breeding endangered Cuban iguanas that are released to their natural habitats and monitored with an electronic device that is inserted beneath the animal's skin. Cuban iguanas are important seed dispersers for many endemic plants, and the loss of the animal would have serious effects on the ecosystem. The Bronx Zoo has also played an important role in the breeding of endangered species in the United States over the years. William Conway is president and general director of the Wildlife Conservation Society, which is part of the zoo. He says one of its most famous captive breeding programs occurred around the turn of the century.
About that time, the American bison was facing extinction. There were only a couple of dozen left in Yellowstone and a few hundred on various farms around the country, mostly in the West and, curiously enough, in the Northeast. The Bronx Zoo gathered as many of these animals together from farms as they could, began breeding them in the southern 40 acres of the zoo, at the same time founded the American Bison Society, convinced the Congress to stop the killing of the bison and to set up new reserves in the West where the bison once ranged. Then, every year from 1907 until 1917, the Society shipped bison from its breeding herds out to Oklahoma, South Dakota, and Montana. Today, there are about 150,000 bison in the United States, and a good many of them could give you a Bronx cheer.
The Bronx Zoo is a member of the American Association of Zoos and Aquariums, or AZA, In an effort to better address the extinction problem, the AZA developed the Species Survival Plan, or SSP, which William Conway helped to create.
What it says, in essence, is that the 185 credited zoos and aquariums of the AZA are going to work together to collaborate to save a series of species that they believe are important, that they have, that they're worried about losing in nature and worried about losing in their zoos and aquariums, by treating them essentially as though they're common property, moving them back and forth, usually without any money changing hands, in order to assure that the animal has the best chance of reproducing.
Wildlife Conservation Society has played a key role in the SSP. Staff members help monitor the genetic and demographic management of the entire North American captive population of a given species, and the Society is involved with 58% of all species survival plans. Today, WCS is helping to propagate a number of animals, including Chinese alligators, pygmy chimpanzees, Andean condors, and black lemurs, just to name a few. Saving large animals from extinction is obviously good for the planet, but it raises the question of how much effort should be devoted to reproducing less charismatic forms of life, like insects, that also play important roles in the food chain and the overall health of ecosystems. Dr. Betsy Dresser is Senior Vice President of Research at the Audubon Institute Center for Research of Endangered Species in New Orleans, Louisiana.
It's going to be beyond my lifetime, probably, but someday I think we are going to need to be able to reproduce or manage in some way an insect population, as well as a snail population or a lot of aquatic invertebrates, all of those things. Here in New Orleans, we're building a new insectarium, and part of the reason for it is to be able to learn how to culture these animals.
But William Conway with the Wildlife Conservation Society believes the overall contribution of captive breeding programs is extremely small. He says preserving genetic material by freezing so plants and animals can be reproduced in the future is important, but the trend is really towards mega zoos, large protected natural areas. Conway says WCS is mostly concerned with preserving natural habitats, which in the long run will save more species.
What good is a bison frozen in a straw in a deep freeze? So modern zoos have to have a two-pronged approach. They've got to work like the devil to encourage the preservation of nature, to encourage the preservation of wild animals in nature, at the same time hedging our bets by trying to sustain species that are losing their homes for a sufficiently lengthy time so that there may be a chance of reintroducing them.
Endangered species breeding programs are helping to save some species from extinction, but zoos only have a limited amount of space. So where will we put the plants and animals we propagate in the future if habitats are gone? And are we willing to restore habitats we have already converted to satisfy some human desire? For The Environment Show, I'm Stephen Westcott.
Thanks for being with us on this week's Environment Show. I'm Peter Burley. Are the grizzly bears eating the wood duck? Will low-level radioactive waste cook some of us before the climate change negotiations could stop global warming? It's all terribly confusing, and listening to the show again won't help. Try it and see. Order show number 509 by calling 1-800-323-9262. The Environment Show is a national production which is solely responsible for its content. Alan Chartok is executive producer, Stephen Westcott is producer, and the show is made possible by the W. Alton Jones Foundation, the William Bingham Foundation, the Turner Foundation, the J.M. Kaplan Fund, and Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the collector car hobby. www.hemmings.com. Be good to the Earth, and join us next week for the Environment Show.